Today is May 23rd, 2014. This is Desiree Hargis on behalf of the H.J. Lucher Stark Center for Physical Culture and Sports. As part of the 1968 U.S. Olympic Team Legacy Archive, I am interviewing Barbara Friedrich over the phone about her experiences in the 1968 Olympic Games in Mexico City. Barbara, can you begin with when and where you were born?
I was born January 18, 1949, in Newark, New Jersey.
Can you tell me a little bit about your family and where you grew up?
The first 2 years of my life, we were up in Newark, and then we moved down the Jersey Shore, where the Sandy Storm occurred, in Spring Lake Heights, New Jersey, in 1952, and with my mother and my father. I'm the only child, and that's it.
Mm-hmm. What were your earliest athletic pursuits?
Competing in the Spring Lake Heights recreation program down the road here in my own town, and we had a track meet every summer. So I did the 50-yard dash, the 100-yard dash, the baseball throw, and there was a high jump and a long jump. And that's when I first started, mm-hmm. and when I was little. And then I moved on to 8th grade, and I competed in the physical fitness test that we used to have, the President's Physical Fitness Test. And I threw the softball 230 feet, and my health and physical education teacher, Mr. Philip Fannin, who was a javelin thrower himself, said, "You're a javelin thrower. Tell your mom to go out and buy a javelin for you and join the boys' track team when you go to Manasquan High School." So luckily, the Manasquan High School coach, George Bauer, took me under his wings for 4 years, and my mom bought the javelin for me. My dad would help travel me all over from Maine all the way down to Virginia to see if I could get to all these track meets, giving up his Sundays because he worked 6 days a week. And then I went into King College, and I did not have a girls' track team to belong to, so I did it on my own with Mr. Bauer. I would come home on the weekends. Mr. Bauer would coach me on the side. And I tried out for the 1964 Olympic Games trials in Randall's Island, New York, coming in 7th place. And my biggest goal was to beat Babe Dickerson's longest throw, which I did well, with 147 feet. Did not make the team. Tried out for 68, became number one American record holder in 67. And the Olympic trials were in 68, came in number one. Tried out for 72, and tried out for 76. And then I tried out for 1980 and only made one Olympic team.
While you were growing up and focusing on the javelin, did you have any sports role models or heroes at the time?
Yes, I did. Babe Dickerson, Mildred Zaharias Dickerson, was my role model. My goal was to win the gold medal in the Olympics and to become a professional golfer. So one day my coach, Mr. Bauer, again, said to me, "Bobby, you do not go out for golf. You'll never make it. It's only like $5,000 a year money." And I went on to college to become a teacher so I'd be able to so I wouldn't starve, you know, so I have money to live on. And that's it.
Mm-hmm.
But I did compete in other sports. I did field hockey. I made varsity basketball. I did tennis. I did golf, bowling, softball, and was pretty good at it. I probably could have made the Olympic team in all of them if I tried out for the Olympics for each one.
Mm-hmm.
But my goal was to be like Babe Dickerson, to be a good golfer. I didn't go into golfing. I ended up becoming a health and physical education teacher, teaching 32 years in grammar school from K to 12 in health and phys ed.
Wow, that's quite a career. Was it fun?
Pardon?
Was it fun being a physical education teacher? Did you enjoy
it? I enjoyed it. Yes, I had the children, the students I had in the 1970s and 80s and 90s. They looked up to me like a role model. So I became a role model to them. Like I was, like Babe Dickerson was my role model. I became their role model. So they did very well in track. One girl, one javelin thrower of mine broke the state record. And two other throwers, they tried, but they ended up with injuries.
Hmm.
And I also did track officiating along with my husband for 25 years. So I was a head javelin official, like on the runway, and my husband would do the marking. We did everything from the local all the way up to the state level.
Hmm.
So I've been in track and field for almost 45 years.
It's a long time.
It is a long time.
So,
and most of the time, as an amateur athlete. And coaching, we made very little. And in track officiating, you know, we make good pocket money, but you can't live on it. Yeah. So I did it for the enjoyment of the sport. You're right.
Yeah. Well, Barbara, going back to the 1968 Olympic trials, can you tell me a little bit about how the trials worked? What was the process and what happened? Were there any problems or challenges that you faced during the trials?
The only challenge I had was I got very sick before the javelin event because I went up to high altitude up in Denver, Colorado. I live at the sea level. So I ended up with a bloody nose when I got off the airplane, and I got very sick, you know, stomach problems. I lost 10 pounds before I threw the javelin, but I still managed to come in first place and made the team.
Hmm.
I had to place top three and hit the qualifying mark during the season, so I did both of them. The qualifying mark was done at an earlier meet, but I had to place top three to get on to the next step, the Olympics.
Mm-hmm.
So I thought I would do pretty good for a sick person.
Certainly. Can you describe your training regimen after you made the team while you were, at Olympic training camp? Were you lifting weights? What did your training regimen consist of?
Well, going back to high school, I used to do about 200 push-ups every single night. I should say 200. I didn't say about. And I kept track of it. And I did it in bunches of 25 because there was no weightlifting back then in the 1960s. And I did every event. I did the 100, the 220, the 440, the 880, the mile, did the shot, discus, javelin, and long jump and high jump, waiting for the coach, boys track coach, George Bauer, to finish coaching with the boys. So as a result, I became like a superhuman. You know, I was doing all these events here, and all these events here helped me become an international athlete in the javelin.
Mm-hmm.
No drugs, nothing. I didn't take any drugs. It was a matter of doing it for 4 hours every day, training.
Mm-hmm. Can you tell me about training at altitude in preparation for the altitude at Mexico City?
All right. The girls' track team, we ended up in Los Alamos, New Mexico, and we had to stay there for about a whole month before we were flown out to Mexico City. And it wasn't easy. The air was very thin, you know, where we were. It was about 5,000 to 6,000 feet high, and we got acclimated. We made enough red blood cells in our system. We were able to breathe better after that.
Mm-hmm.
We had to stay in there for a month. And the men's track team were in Las Vegas. We were out in the middle of a desert in Los Alamos, where the atomic bomb was invented, or they, you know, let it go mm-hmm. in the desert.
Hmm.
So it was kind of an isolated place where we were. We were entertained in the movie theaters. We trained, and there wasn't too much to do for us out there. We just ate, sleep, train, and went to a movie theater, and that's it.
Hmm. How did your friends and family and, you know, people at school, people who knew you, how did they react to finding out that you'd made the Olympic team?
Well, my grandmother and grandfather were very proud of me, and especially my dad. He was against me doing all this. But my grandmother and grandfather were kind of, they're Ukrainian immigrants from Ukraine. And my grandfather was so proud that he put me in the Ukrainian newspaper, and he was out there, you know, showing it to everybody. And my dad was funny. When I broke the U.S. record, he put a fence out here, and he showed my javelin that I threw with on the fence. He nailed it, and he put American record holder. And my mom was proud of me that making sure I got into all these track meets. You know, she would travel with me to the far distance ones, like if we flew out to California, she would go with me, but my dad had to stay home to work. And it wasn't easy being an amateur athlete, not having a job, and trying to go to these track meets, and nobody would give me money to go out to California to compete against the girls who were really good out there. That was the competitors were out in California. There wasn't too many out here on the East Coast. So it was not easy. It was not easy to stay on top. So during the winter time, what I used to do, I used to throw the basketball during the winter. And believe it or not, that was an event in the indoor national track meet in Madison Square Garden or out in California. You throw the basketball for distance.
Really?
And I threw it like 135 feet, which is like 2 or 3 inches short of the world's record by Earlene Brown. So that's how I stayed in shape, throwing in the snow out here on the East Coast. So I'd be ready to compete against these, you know, people out in California when I was ready around May or June.
Yeah.
I have five national championship titles for the basketball throw.
That's amazing. Well, were you aware of how your training compared to that of your teammates?
I have no idea. I don't know how they trained out in California. I had no idea.
Mm-hmm.
No idea. I had my own training over here, and I just did it because I was so determined that nothing would stop me. I didn't have too much socializing. I didn't socialize. I didn't go out with anybody. I was pretty focused on being the best in the world. And in those days, it was hard. You don't have a cell phone, a smartphone. You can't communicate. You were kind of like a loner. And you just go to school. You go out and you train. You come back. And I stayed with my mom and dad at home. And that's the way girls were back then. The parents had to help them.
Yeah. Were you aware of how your international competitors trained, or how your training compared to them, like the competitors from Hungary, Romania, Austria?
They were all communist countries. Yes, they were taken away from their homes, and they were put in a camp somewhere, and the government would take care of them. They would feed them, give them a place to sleep. They had weight training. They had top technicians, and we didn't have that kind of stuff here. We did it on our own. You had to find a private coach, and you stay with that coach if you feel that this coach is going to help you get there.
Mm-hmm.
So there was no such thing like they have organized sports today for children. There was no such thing. You're on your own.
Hmm. Did you have any friends on the U.S. Olympic team?
Any fun?
Friends. Any friends?
Oh, friends. No, they were all over the country. So we didn't have emailing. We didn't have cell phones. We didn't have any communication. We just like say hello, goodbye, we'll see you next time.
Uh-huh.
So there was no, I didn't really associate with any of the other athletes because I focused on my event. I didn't believe in socializing before the event like some athletes did. They're the ones that never made it anyway because I told them not to. I said, you sit in a hotel and you focus on what you're going to do. You don't smile and laugh with them, and then you're going to throw something with them, this shot, discus, javelin. How could you throw far when you're too friendly with them?
Yeah,
you can't be too friendly with your teammates until you make the team, USA team, international team, Olympic team. Then you can do anything you want. You made the team, it doesn't matter anymore. But before the competition, you don't make friends with anybody. You don't say hello to anybody. You just hide, compete, and then you say hello afterwards. And that's how I found myself successful.
Uh-huh. Well, once you had made the team and you were together in Mexico City in the Olympic Village, who were your friends there?
I really didn't hang around with any of them. I just hung around a group and that's it. There was no friends. I just hung around because they were my teammates. I didn't have a close friend or anything. I had a roommate in Los Alamos, Karen Callahan, which I met down in Austin.
Mm-hmm.
And she kept screaming, "Oh, this is my roommate. So I must have made a little, impact on her.
Yeah.
She was glad to have me as a roommate.
Yeah.
But after that, we never kept in touch. The only people I kept in touch with one Australian athlete when I competed in Los Angeles Coliseum back in the late 70s. I mean, Diane Pease and I, she's from Sydney, Australia, and she sat next to me. She was a number one long jumper. And I said, how would you like to be pen pals with me? So we've been writing since 1967, 68, way back then. For 40 years, we've been pen pal, and she did come to visit me, and we keep in touch on the email. And another athlete, Mary Thomas from Australia, we keep in touch from Wollongong, Australia. She's a national world everything, shot, discus, javelin, hammer, champion of all events, and she's been competing for 50 years now. Those are the only thing I made. I made friends internationally in Australia and one in Germany, another Barbara Friedrich, because she heard me. When I set the U.S. record, she heard me on Radio Europe, Free Europe, where they were able to listen to the radio under communism. And then she wrote a congratulations letter to the care of the New York Times. And New York Times gave me the letter. So we've been pen pals for 40, 50 years now.
Wow. That's
so
pretty cool.
I made
cool.
more friends internationally than I did with my own, teammates.
Yeah. So looking at the roster for the final standings for 1968, you were 19, and there was only one other 19-year-old, so you were amongst the youngest in the final standings. How do you feel? Do you feel that played any part in the results or in your experience?
Being young, it had nothing to do with it because I was ranked, right through the 198, I was ranked number one in the world for 3 months. So But age has nothing to do with it. I had an injury a month before the games. So I dropped 25 feet from my American record down to the 170s. So I was a little disappointed that we had no trainers. We had no physical therapist to help us at home to get us back on our feet again. There was no such thing. You were on your own. There was nobody there helping you. And you couldn't take drugs because they tested you for the drugs. If you won a medal, they gave you blood work. And if you took some kind of painkiller, then you would have been in trouble. You would have lost the medal.
Well,
things are different back then.
Yeah, for sure. Before the Olympic Games, maybe while you were at Los Alamos, do you remember hearing anything about possible protests or boycotts by members of the U.S. track team?
I mean, I didn't get that. What of the track team?
Possible. Do you remember hearing anything while you were in Los Alamos about possible boycotts or protests?
Nothing. Mm-hmm. I knew nothing about the blacks boycotting at all. Nothing.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't know until it happened. When I threw the javelin, and I finished with the javelin on the field, I went back to go underneath the stadium, and I started crying because I did so bad. And I went up into the stands with my parents and my coach and my Aunt Jean and Harriet. And then I saw them. There they were. They went up on the stands, the three of them, the three black athletes. They put their hands up. And I said, wow, what's going on here? No, I knew nothing about it until I got into the Olympic Village. And then Edith McGuire, or Wyoming Attire, was with me. And I said, what's going on? What's this fist up in the air? And they try to explain to me that that's black power, that when we win a gold medal, it isn't worth anything. When we get back home, it doesn't do anything for us. There's no bigger recognition. There's no money. There's no endorsement. And they go back where they live, you know, in the ghetto, I guess the ghetto, or a poor area.
Hmm.
So I was naive. I knew nothing what was going on.
Mm-hmm. Did you remember hearing anything about student protests by students in Mexico City about 10 days before the start of the games?
Yes, my mother and my Aunt Jean Lewinsky and Harriet Holstein, they took a bus ride from Mexico City back to Pueblo. That's where they lived. And they went right into the revolution. They went right into it, and the police had to guard them, go around the revolution and get them back to Pueblo. So they came to me and told me all about it, that the students were revolting out down there. That's how I found out, through my relatives.
And in
the Olympic Stadium, I knew nothing about it until my mother and my aunt and her friend told me about it. Otherwise, I wouldn't have known anything about it.
Huh. So was there anything that stands out in your mind that they told you about it?
As far as the team managers, nothing.
Okay. When you first arrived in Mexico City, what were your impressions of the city and the people?
We got off the airplane. We saw all the young children sitting up on the roof, the little Mexican children, and the bandoras they were playing, the big guitars that they were playing. And it was such a great feeling that they welcomed us with happiness, with smiling faces. And that was the best feeling I ever had when I arrived at that airport.
And did you get to venture out into the city or go sightseeing or meet anyone from Mexico City?
With my mother and my aunt and her friend, we went to see the pyramids and we got to see the floating garden. And then I went again with my teammates out to the pyramids again. And as far as meeting famous people, let's see, I spoke to Prince Phillips from England, and I spoke to another cowboy, famous star. I forgot his name. My husband's not around to help me. I don't know where he is. I'm trying to think here. Oh, well, he's not around. Yeah, it was a famous cowboy with a black hat. I forgot what his name is. I don't know where. I'm trying to find him here. I don't know why he disappears like this on me. Just hold on a second. I'll try to find out.
Okay.
Yes, I met Hugh O'Brien, and he said he would go out in the stands. He would watch for me in the javelin. We met Jesse Owens because he was able to have he got a get-together with us as a team to wish us luck, and that's about it.
Hmm. What did you think of the event venues and athletic facilities?
how do I think about the athletic facilities?
Yes, the event venues and athletic facilities that were, you know, specially prepared for the Olympic Games in Mexico City. What were your impressions of those venues and facilities?
The transportation from the Olympic Village was beautiful. We just go right into the tunnel and we just wait for our event. And then when you walk in, there was 100,000 people. And what they did, they allow the poor Mexicans that couldn't afford a ticket, they let them in, and they all sat up on top of the wall. So, I mean, it looked like the gladiators here, like when they have a lot of people packed in this one stadium. It was overwhelming, the amount of people that were in that stadium.
Hmm.
That's the impression I got. It was like, you know, the young kid looking at all these people, oh, boy, that's the biggest crowd I ever saw on a track meet here.
Yeah. What were your impressions of the security measures at the games?
They didn't bother me that much. One time I got lost with a taxi driver. My aunt, my mother, and her friend, they put me in a taxi, and my aunt says to take me back to the Olympic Village. She spoke in Spanish to the taxi driver, and the taxi driver ended up sending me over to an army camp. And I said, no, Olympic Abelia. So he brought me back, and I saw this big keyhole, and I said, uh-oh, now a curfew. It's a good thing I had that hanging thing around my neck, and I told the security guard, I'm coming back late with my relatives. And he said, okay, come on in. So they were pretty tight on the if you were past the curfew, they really checked on you back then.
Hmm. Describe your accommodations in the Olympic Village. What was the room situation like?
Well, one morning, I was brushing my teeth, and the water started dripping from the ceiling and landed on my toothbrush and glass, and I continued using it instead of rinsing it, and I ended up with Montezuma's Revenge. I had diarrhea after that.
Oh.
But the plumbing was not too good, and one of our throwers sat on the toilet seat, and it broke. So the toilet seat wasn't made too well in the facility, but it was comfortable. We had our own little bed, and it was beautiful to see a Mexican blanket, Olympic blanket for a souvenir. And I said, wow, we got a souvenir from the Olympic Village. It was so nice that the little gifts that they gave us.
Cool. What was the food like?
Very good. No complaints from me, because I'm big on food, boy. I was never unhappy with breakfast, lunch, and dinner. I have a cute story that went with the cafeteria.
Okay.
I asked one of the black athletes to go up on the ceiling and steal one of those Olympic balloons for me. And he ran to the Olympic Village, you know, back to the women's village, and the poor Mexican cafeteria worker was trying to get it back from him. So I have a souvenir balloon from the cafeteria. I feel bad about it, but I just wanted it so badly. It was beautiful the way it was designed. And then when I went to Austin, Texas, 2 years ago, I met the designer of the balloon. I brought it, and he says, I designed it. And I said, oh, my God, what a small world this is.
Yeah.
So maybe it was meant that I was supposed to take that with me so that this designer would be able to see his own balloon, and we showed it off to everybody.
Yeah.
The only balloon around.
That was really neat. I remember seeing that when I was there as well. That was really cool. So you mentioned having some intestinal illness while you were there from the water. Did anyone else you know have any water or foodborne intestinal illness?
Yeah, a couple of our teammates did have Montezuma's Revenge. That was the only complaint we had. A couple of us had it.
Hmm.
And nothing else happened.
Did that Montezuma's Revenge affect their Olympic performance?
No, it didn't bother me because I was able to recuperate after a couple of days. But let's see, one thrower, she got sick with the diarrhea, and she still threw pretty well. No, it was just a couple of days.
I see.
A little bit of dysentery, like, that's all.
Yeah.
We didn't end up in the hospital or anything.
I see. What are your memories of the opening ceremony, your most vivid memories from that opening ceremony?
Okay, I sat out during the Olympic opening ceremonies because I had to compete the next day, and we had to stand for 8 hours. I would have been too tired for competition the next day, so a bunch of us sat out because we had to compete the next day. And it was overwhelming to see 10,000 people come in, and they were all Olympians. It's amazing, from all over the world. And it was so peaceful seeing the balloons go up and the doves going up. And it's so colorful. And the stadium was packed. And that's it. It was beautiful. I mean, it's the only one I was able to watch. So I was so glad I made it just to go see the opening ceremonies.
Hmm. Did you have any memorable interactions or experiences with people from other national teams? They're at
the... I tried to make friends at the village with one Russian athlete, and I spoke to him in Ukrainian. You know, I tell him that I spoke Ukrainian, and he walked away from me. You know, he didn't like me because I was Ukrainian.
Hmm.
He was Ukrainian American, so the Russian didn't like me. So it's still going on today with that Putin over there.
Yeah.
You know, some Ukrainians don't like Russians. The Russians don't like Ukrainians. So it has nothing to do with me personally. It was the politics, you know, between the two countries. But I'm trying to think who else I hung around with. I hung around with Edith McGuire and her friend from the Puma company. They tried to take me down to Acapulco, and I couldn't because I had to compete again. You know, that next day they wanted to go on the day of the opening ceremonies. I didn't go. I was afraid to go too far away. But, you know, people mingle with me. Ralph Boston talks to me. He talked to me a lot. Willie Davenport was a good buddy of mine on the team. We went to China together to compete over in China, and he kept me company because I didn't want to do the other things that the athletes were doing at night. You know, they were doing bad things like that they weren't supposed to, and I wasn't involved with it. So Willie said, I'll keep you company. So I was good friends with Willie Davenport and Ralph Boston. We were supposed to play golf at one time, Ralph Boston and I, with Jack Whitaker, the newsman, famous newsman from television, but we didn't get around to it. And then when I was in China, I was supposed to play tennis with George Bush Sr., but he never showed up. We were supposed to have a round of tennis over in Peking. So I get around somehow. You know, I do talk to people, but I don't go crazy like some of these athletes do. They go partying at night. I'm not a party type. I focus on the event and try to stay out of trouble.
Mm-hmm. So you mentioned the one Soviet athlete that you tried to have an interaction with. With 1968 being the height of the Cold War in Vietnam, what effect, if any, did this political climate have on the games in general and interactions between athletes?
We played ping pong. It broke the ice a little bit. We did play ping pong with each other.
Oh, okay.
And we sat around, we listened to music, we were dancing in the Olympic Village. So I don't think there was any cold feeling between anybody. We were just glad to be busy playing ping pong and relaxing and taking a swim in the pool. But when you went back to your place where you live, you don't have other athletes from other countries coming into your place. We had our own private place.
Hmm.
There's no mingling at where we lived, only out where the pool was, the ping pong and music, but we did mingle.
Hmm.
So politics did not occur at the Olympic Village when it came to those areas there.
Yeah. These were the first games in which a team from the East Germany or German Democratic Republic competed. Did you have any experiences or memories of the athletes from the new East German team?
Nothing. I didn't even know they were around, except on the javelin field. And she came in, I think the girl, one of the German girls competed. But we didn't, no association, nothing at all.
These were the first summer games at which kind of a standardized drug testing was implemented. Did you have any experience or recollections of the testing program in 1968?
I had nothing to do with it because I didn't win any medal, but we had a sex test where they scraped the cheeks out to see if you were a male or a female.
Mm-hmm.
And there were some athletes that got disqualified. They were more male than they were female.
Hmm.
They couldn't compete against women. And then you had to take your clothes off to show that you were a female.
And how did you feel about all of that?
Well, you know, being prudy over here and modest, you know, it was tough.
Mm-hmm.
We don't do it at home. I don't do it in front of my parents. I don't do it in front of my friends here. You know, it was hard, you know. And they gave you privacy. You know, you had a curtain there. So it was just between you and whoever the person was, the doctor or whatever, whoever it was. And then we got a certificate that we passed.
Hmm. no feelings other than that about it?
Like, no, nothing. It didn't bother me, but mm-hmm. it makes it more fair if somebody, I don't know, if somebody's more male than female, they were born that way, they can't help it. I can't express my opinion about that, what nature did to some of these people.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not an expert on that.
Mm-hmm. So you already mentioned the Smith and Carlos black glove salute on the medal stand. And witnessing that, once you found out what it was about and what was going on, what did you think about it, or how did you feel about what took place?
I started feeling bad for them. I believed in what they said, you know, that when they go back home and they work so hard for the event and they go nowhere, they don't have a job and there's no scholarship, there's no college, nobody pays attention. They brought up a good point. They're trying to wake up the American world that here I am with a gold medal. What are you going to do for me? What do I gain out of it? See, I did it for the love of the sport. I wouldn't have cared if I had gotten the gold medal, but I'm not a black person. See, I wasn't brought up in a black family and where you weren't allowed to drink in a water fountain. You weren't allowed to sit on the bus. You had to sit in the front. You couldn't go to the boys' room here. You had to go to the boys' room over here because you were black. See, I didn't go through all that because I'm a white person and Caucasian, I should say. So after hearing about what they did, I kind of felt bad for them. I kind of agreed with what they did. You know, I see where they're coming from. They got tired of it, of representing a country that didn't appreciate what they did.
Mm-hmm. What are your memories of the media, the TV cameras, journalists, reporters, photographers? Did you have any memories of any of that that stick out in your mind?
I didn't have any cameras. I didn't have anything at the Olympics. No photos, no nothing.
Mm-hmm. Did any of your friends and family back home mention watching the games on television?
No, I don't think they even saw me on television.
Mm-hmm.
I don't even think they put the woman's javelin on TV.
Mm-hmm.
The only memory I have, they put on a big parade for me before I left. And that got everybody in the whole town involved at the Little League Field, which was good. Because my grandma was so proud. You know, my coach was invited to come over. That was the only recognition I really got, a big photo album of the memory of the Olympic parade, sending me off, wishing me luck. And then it was never the same after that. It was just like being part of a team in the Olympic Games, and there's no recognition.
Huh. Did you get to attend other events and witness any, pretty amazing events or record-setting events while you were there in Mexico City?
I saw the Fosbury flop the first time they showed that they jumped backwards on the closing ceremony. That's the one that made a big impression on me, watching Dick Fosbury going up backwards over the high jump, which I've never seen before, and he was going over like 7 feet 4 inches, and that was impressive. And after the event was over, we all participated in the closing ceremony right after that. So that was the only event that I got really to see, is the high jump.
Hmm. For you personally, what was the most meaningful or memorable part of competing in the 68 games?
Meaningful. Being happy that I made it. I was able to make it. I mean, all the hours of training, 4 hours a day and 4 years on a boys' track team in high school, and making it. And being the only one, like, in the history of the high school, the history of the college, and the history of the state to make it in the javelin, that's about the only meaningful I could think of. And it got me a job teaching.
Mm-hmm.
And I taught 32 years as a health and phys ed teacher and coached girls track for 9 years. I did indoor track and track officiating for 25. So that's about what the Olympic Games did for me. It opened up the doors for me.
Uh-huh.
For a job and to continue in this sport in a different way and to help other students get where I was, go as far as they can. But they got scholarships in college, so I'm glad they got scholarships, which is a big help. I've accomplished something. I've done something for them that somebody else did for me.
Yeah.
So the Olympic Games, that's what the Olympic Games do for you. They open up doors for you down the road.
Well, that leads to another question I have. What has been the impact of being an Olympian on your life?
You get more respect from people as a woman. especially when you're, I'll give you an example. When I did the track officiating one day for freshman, sophomore boys, they looked at me like, oh boy, look who's running this show here. Like I'm some kind of woman that doesn't know what she's doing. So one young man started challenging me. He wouldn't take his sweatpants off and his shirt because he had to show me his uniform underneath. And I said, fine, go get your coach. And the coach gave me a hard time because I'm a woman probably. And I said, oh, good, go get the meet director. And the meet director bounced off the two of them and said, she's correct. So I lined up all the boys up in the order of the way they throw. And I said, guess what, boys? I happen to be an Olympian in this event in 1968, American record holder. And you give me a hard time in this event? And then the cute thing is, then all of a sudden they started showing off how far they can throw. They're so funny. And I would give them a compliment. I said, oh, boy, nice throw. And they really like that. They like hearing that from another Olympian, from an Olympian telling them. Mm. So it kind of gave me some strength when it comes to track officiating. These coaches would brag about me, and they would be nice when they're competing. They don't give me a hard time. And that's it. And that's one advantage of being an Olympian. Or if you're on the street and you, if I tell a doctor in the hospital I'm an Olympian, and they go, oh boy, it's like, you know, it's like a VIP all of a sudden. It does do something to other people because they don't see too many Olympians in their lifetime. They say, you're the first Olympian I ever met. It really makes life easier by having that title.
Yeah, that's wonderful.
Especially as a woman.
Yes. Yeah, I can see that.
If I'm teaching high school students and I tell them that I'm an Olympian and I tell them about my past, you know, all my experience and stuff, and then they go out for sports themselves because they want to be just like me. I think it's a great thing. It's a great feeling.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Barbara, were you there at the closing ceremony in 68?
Yeah, I watched the, I didn't compete. We all sat in the stands, like, only a few people were chosen to be in it. So I sat right by the high jump, like I told you, Dick Fosbury high jump. And we had to wave this little Olympic flag, and everybody waved it when they announced the next Olympics coming up, which was in Munich in Germany.
Mm-hmm.
Anything? Yeah, we didn't get to really compete. The whole team doesn't compete in the closing ceremonies. We had to sit in the stands and watch a few people from each country come in.
Uh-huh. How did you feel about that?
It was kind of sad when they closed, you know, they closed the ceremony down, and I said, well, this is it. It was a beautiful 2 weeks there. It was just like overwhelming with the food and the people and the spirit and the Mexicans. The Mexicans were so nice. They're just so ultra nice down there. They were so happy all the time to see us. And that's a great feeling.
Mm-hmm.
And we didn't have that security stuff that they had in the last Olympics where you couldn't wear your uniform. Everybody wore their uniforms around the street. So we got to, you know, get to look at each other and see what we look like in different uniforms without worrying about somebody's going to go after us, you know, like they did over in Sochi. They weren't allowed to wear their uniforms in the village.
Huh.
They were afraid the terrorists would be after them.
Yeah.
So we had a nice, happy family there. We were very comfortable. We were safe. We felt very safe there.
Hmm. Well, that's good.
Friendly atmosphere.
Barbara, what were your personal experiences with amateurism, eligibility rules about gifts and support, payment, and sponsors? And what are your thoughts about the way the amateurism rules played out back in the 60s?
Well, we got a per diem, $1.50 a night, a day, and that was our allowance that we had. And my parents didn't have any money to give me, so I lived on $1.50 a day, so I couldn't buy too much. I had to wait till I got enough per diem so I'd be able to buy a nice souvenir to bring back. And then I would come home, and I would have to get a job in the summertime and then go back to my teaching and coaching. There's nothing more I can say about that. I forgot what the question is. Can I repeat the question again?
That you answered it. I was just asking about, you know, what your personal experiences were with the rules of amateurism in the 60s.
Yes, we couldn't accept any money. We couldn't accept anybody to sponsor us. I had a beer company locally over here down the Jersey Shore here. They wanted to sponsor me, and I would have the word beer company name on my shirt. And they were going to pay my way to go to California so I'd be able to compete against the good athletes out there. And the AAU wouldn't allow me to get money. So I'd be able to go out there and compete and get those competitors more competition.
Which beer company was that, just out of curiosity?
Schlitz Company.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Well, that's too bad.
My neighbor worked for it.
Oh.
And he got some sponsors for me, but they weren't allowed to give it to me to get out to California.
That's really too bad.
And my coach, I wasn't allowed to accept money as a coach while I was coaching high school as an amateur athlete competing in the javelin. So I coached for free until I finished competing. So I was coaching for nothing. I wasn't getting any pay. And then the Board of Education would not increase my teacher's salary so I'd be able to get paid for coaching through a teacher's salary. They wouldn't do it for me.
That leads to the next question about amateurism. How has it changed from the 60s to now? How do you feel about amateurism as it is now compared to what it used to be?
Well, the amateurism, they're not even amateurs anymore. They become professionals. Like, we have a local girl who's internationally running, AG over here, AG White. And the minute she got into college, she got sponsored by Nike. She gets to travel all over the country anytime she wants to. And she's ranked number top five now in the world right now in the 800. She's doing very well. But she got the red carpet treatment. I never had a red carpet treatment. I just had to wait till I got to the Nationals and see if I could beat the girls that are out there. You know, it was just, she's able to compete with the good athletes all during the whole year, indoor season and outdoor, because Nike is sending her all over the place.
Mm-hmm. And do you feel that this is a good thing for track and track athletes, or a bad thing for track and track athletes? What are your personal feelings on how amateurism has changed? Is it good or bad?
I think it's good because it gives a chance a girl like AG. She comes from a poor area. Here we go. We're going back to the Black Power again. She's a black athlete. Her mother's a male lady. She has no dad that's supporting the family. So Nike helping her out, I think that's good because some athletes need help. But now it's getting too far now that college kids want to get paid for playing basketball. The amateur status is disappearing. There's no such thing as being an amateur anymore.
Mm-hmm.
That I don't like because the college students are really good, like in one sport like basketball, for example. I watch it, the March Madness, and they're beautiful to play. But when I watch the professionals, they're getting paid. It's not the same kind of game. They're doing it for the love of the sport and to make the pros, but the professionals, they're doing it for the love of millions of dollars. There's two different kinds of athletes we have now today. Those are the ones I don't like. The athletes in college are getting paid, and the professionals getting paid too much.
Barbara, what one piece of advice would you give to today's Olympic hopeful?
Focus on your event and do it for the love of the sport. Because once you get old, you're going to look back and say, wow, I'm glad I was able to do it. Do it for the love of the sport, because you're not going to be able to do it forever. It's like youth cannot be denied. Do it while you're a youth and enjoy it.
Sounds like very good advice. Well, Barbara, I've used up almost an hour of your time. Is there anything?
You did?
Yeah.
It's enjoyable. I like talking about myself. You don't do it too often, you know.
Yeah. Well, is there anything else that you would like to get on the recording before we end?
Yeah, there's one more. Right before I had to compete, my mother and my aunt and her friend Harriet were in the hotel reforma, and my mother started to cry, and Jesse Owens came over and said, what's the matter? My daughter has to compete pretty soon, and I can't get to the stadium. And he says, don't worry about it. We'll get you over there. And I thought that was pretty nice that she was able to get there on time to be able to see me.
Oh, wow. And Jesse Owens helped get her there on time?
And she was he was in the lobby when he came over, and he asked her why she was crying, because they were coming all the way from Puebla, 90 miles, and the bus broke down, and they had to get another bus. She just made it to the hotel reformer, and then she had to get another bus to get to the stadium. And he said, don't worry, you're going to make it. So it's just the encouragement from Jesse Owens. That was a big help. And he gave her a photo with his autograph to make her feel good.
Oh, wow.
And I have a copy of it, yeah.
That's a really cool story. Well, is there anything else you'd like to add?
That's it.
Okay.
I'm just so glad that I made the team. My family, the town supported me. My coach supported me all these years. And I don't know. I'm just glad that I was able to have the talent that God gave me. And I made the team, and it opened up doors for me for the rest of my life.